This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So it's all over. Spain is champion. The World Cup is done. How do you rate it? What score out of 10? If it's not 10 out of 10, tell me what lost the points for you. I want to hear your highlights and lowlights. I'd love to hear from you. On The Conversation Hour this morning on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria, tell me, what did you think? There was plenty happening on the pitch, off the pitch. And what did you think of that final this morning? And Spain ending up victorious. Let me know on The Conversation Hour. Also today, what are your pet hates as a pedestrian, particularly ones that might put you in danger? Is it cars? Is it bikes? Is it road design? Is it other pedestrians? What's made it potentially more dangerous to be moving around on foot in Victoria, not just in the busy cities, but in our regions, our towns as well? Tell me what is happening. What are the things making you nervous? This is on the back of data from the Transport Accident Commission showing 33 pedestrians were killed on our roads in 2025. That's higher than the five-year average of 22. So what's happening? What's your guess as to why that is happening? What's your observation about how pedestrians are moving about, how things might be getting more dangerous, how pedestrians are interacting with the forms of transport we have on our roads, in our cities and the regions? What's your theory? 1300 222 774 is the number to call on The Conversation Hour today. Also, I want to know, have you seen The Odyssey? Everyone's talking about it. It was just released a few days ago. Tell me what you thought. Surely there can be no spoilers. It is an ancient myth, of course. Let me know. That is coming up on The Conversation Hour. But coming up next, give me your highlights and lowlights of the World Cup.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Tell me, what score out of 10 would you give the World Cup? It's all over after a record long tournament. Dax in Carlton North, what number do you give it?
Hey, good morning, Mary. Maybe like an 8 out of 10, I think. I think it was a brilliant tournament from the fans, like the Scottish fans, like invading Boston.
And then
the Norwegian fans doing the row. I just think it was a really, really lovely tournament. But, 8 out of 10, probably. Just for some of the controversies that sort of always comes around for World Cups, I think.
That is so true, Dax. But I was saying to Raf before, it's almost like our fears of what might happen on and off the pitch have made us all the more relieved that some of those nightmarish scenarios just didn't come to pass.
That's true. Yeah. And the game was great this morning, actually. I think I've watched most games live, kind of pretty fortunate. I don't start work until sort of midday most days. So it's been a hard month, but I don't know what to do with myself now.
Dax, I guess you just turn your mind to our footy. Yeah. Look, good on you. Thank you so much. For Dax, it was 8 out of 10. Do you agree? 1300 222 774. What is the score that you have given the World Cup? It's been so long. How many days was it? How many weeks was it? Let's have a little listen back. This might prompt some of your memories.
Top here's Nestori, great first touch, Nestori, and good now! Connor Metcalf, who's on the burst, Metcalf, it opens up beautifully with a goal to save it in Vancouver! Rogers is crossed, Gordon coming in, Anthony Gordon, the world champions are on the ropes. Oh, yes, there it is! You are looking at the greatest by Ferran Torres! Spain are the champions! The kings of Europe have conquered the world!
Oh, that brings us up to date. What is your score out of 10? Dax gave it 8 out of 10. Give me a call, 1300-222-774. Was it off the pitch? Those fans got you going and won your hearts. What was it about for you? 1300-222-774. Joining me now is Ed White. But before we do, actually, I beg your pardon, Darren from Morella, what's your score?
My score, I'll go with 7.5. The hydration breaks just did my head in.
Oh,
totally unnecessary.
Even when you knew it was hot?
They're professional athletes play.
All right, so that's the whole minus 2.5. Otherwise, did you enjoy it, Darren?
Very much so.
Excellent. What is your score? Do you agree with Darren? What about those breaks? 1300-222-774. Maybe we should throw forward and see what rules they should keep and abandon for the next World Cup. Ed White, as I said, Australian-American sports journalist, joins us now to break it all down. Hello, Ed. How are you going? Now it's all done.
Yeah, it's all done. Hard to believe, actually. Kind of bittersweet. But
like Dax, are you just saying you've got nothing else to do for the next month?
Well, I'll find something to do. But I concur with both of those calls. I'd probably say 8 myself. I think the football was brilliant. I think the hydration break, I agree, was a negative. The intervention or alleged intervention of Donald Trump in the red card was a little bit... bit of a negative. And I think the Argentina team, despite the way it came back, I felt they were very negative throughout the tournament. I think they were didn't really play the beautiful game, so to speak. And I think that sort of left a mark. And I was very, very pleased that Spain got the win this morning, I'll be honest with you.
Right. And is that something, are you talking more about Argentina with that comment than you are with Spain?
I think they played very negative football today, not even having a shot on goal. And obviously the defending was good, but, you know, I would have liked to have seen a better spectacle. I thought Spain played magnificently this morning and it took them a while to break them down. But, and you know what? What's interesting, they now hold the Women's World Cup trophy, the Men's World Cup, and the Euros. So that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. What is your score for the World Cup? 1300-222-774. Do you agree with Ed that it's 8 out of 10? Frank in Torquay, what's your score and why?
Obviously, as someone from Spanish heritage, I'll give it a 10. But
congratulations, Frank.
Yeah, it's what that I'm not sure who your correspondent was, but it's a very good system the Spanish have got. And you know, the unfold heroes is Lamal. I mean, his mother walked across the desert, so he's a son of a refugee, and Nico, he's also the son of refugees from Ghana. So, and wouldn't Trump absolutely hate it to have two Spanish speaking teams? You know, and after all the things he said about Spain, you know, so I think it was very good that we won.
So win-wins all around for Frank. Thank you so much for your call, Frank. Yeah, there are a lot of, apart from anything else, the great narratives of some of the heroes of the World Cup, Ed.
Oh, look, I think we said this when we talked last time, you know, people go to sporting events to see superstars, you know, to see the stars, and they want them to perform. And I think by and large, they did in this World Cup. You had Mbappe, of course, for France, Messi, although not today, but he had a great tournament. Harry Kane and Jude Bellingham of England, Lamine Yamal, as the caller just said. So Holland from Norway. So these guys all performed at the highest level and justified the hype. I mean, how many times do we watch a game and go, I don't see why this guy, you know, what all the hype is about? You couldn't say that about these stars in this World Cup.
You certainly couldn't. 1300-222-774 is the number to call. What score do you give this World Cup? And also, I guess, on the back of some of those comments there, what are the rules, the elements that you'd like to see or not see in the next World Cup? I'm talking to Ed White, who's American-Australian sports journalist, who's been following this closely. Already mentioned has been the hydration break. Of course, we had the VAR interventions in this tournament. What do you think are the things that are going to be carried forward or not, Ed?
I think I would hope the hydration break, again, I agree with the caller. I think if it warrants it, like the Australian Open, you can take a break. But I think to put it in the way they did was pretty cynical in terms of making it just look like a chance to slam in more sponsorship. I like the way they sort of speeded up the game. They didn't let players roll around on the ground. When someone got treatment on the ground, they went off for a minute. I like that. The game seemed much quicker to me. And I really like that aspect of it. So I think to keep that going, I think is good to hurry up the throw-ins, things like that. I've just felt the games were a lot quicker than normal, and I really like that. And the other thing, Mary, to think about, and we've got 4 years to talk about it, is whether it goes to 64 teams now instead of 48. So that's on the cards.
Well, what's your point of view on that? What direction should the World Cup be going in?
I don't mind the fact that it's getting a little bit more inclusive. And some of the teams that people were very skeptical of, particularly Cape Verde, did incredibly well, even Curaçao. The problem with the 48 was you had these weird things where some third-place teams got in and didn't, and it created some strange matchups in this round of 32. And that's where I didn't think it was that fair in a way. So 64 would allow them to make the groups a little more fair and equitable, but where do you get the rest of the teams from? Although, you know what, my son and I went through it, and there were a lot of teams, Italy, one of them, for example, Denmark, that didn't make it in, Hungary's another one. So there are some good teams out there, Nigeria, Gabon. So you might be able to make it work. So I just think it's inevitable that FIFA wants to get more teams around the planet involved.
This on text, Ed, players 10 out of 10. FIFA, 5 out of 10. Trump, 3 out of 10. That's from David in Armstrong Creek. Yeah, we haven't really talked about FIFA per se. You've implied it there. But, wow, they've got some ground to make up in terms of reputation, don't they?
Well, they do, but they always have.
And that start from a start that wasn't ideal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at a book right on my bookshelf by Andrew Jennings years ago called Foul that was talking about the corruption during the Sepp Blatter era. So now you've got Infantino in there. He's being accused of the same things. I mean, FIFA's always had these issues. I'm not sure you're ever going to change it, to be honest with you, but you're right. It always kind of leaves a weird lingering taste, and I think just adding Trump into the mix probably made it a little stranger than normal. But you're always going to have this with the U.S. World Cup, and the benefits of it were great crowds, as the caller mentioned at the start off the top. You had packed houses, you had great television ratings, you had teams in the community, like, you know, connecting with the U.S. grassroots community. Spain was in Chattanooga, Tennessee, at a prep school. That's where they had their training camp. So, you know, you had a lot of benefits of it that you kind of have to take the good with the bad, in my opinion. Obviously, I'm a little bit biased having lived in the States, but I do think, you know, looking at it, if you had the odds would be pretty short that Trump would somehow get involved.
Indeed. Yes. The issue of Trump, the figure, the shadow of Trump is running through the texts as well. My rating for this World Cup, says David, 20 out of 10, but solely because Donald Trump's moment in the spotlight was clouded because the team from the hopeless country of bad people won and Spain had the last laugh. Yeah, a World Cup without politics we still haven't had. Ed, thank you so much for all of your help, and we will be checking in with you, especially as the Football World continues, as it does for the next 4 years.
And also the league's starting in about a month, so here we go.
here we go. Ed Wyatt, thank you. Ed Wyatt is an American-Australian sports journalist. Keep those calls and texts coming about your scores of the World Cup on The Conversation, 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Coming up soon, we will be talking about your pet peeve as a pedestrian. We've heard disturbing reports about the number of pedestrian deaths in Victoria up last year on the five-year average. What's your theory about that? But also, let's continue with a little bit more sport. You might have heard the news over the weekend that the Tassie Devils have their inaugural coach, Ken Hinckley. What's your verdict on that?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, did you see that the Tassie Devils have their inaugural coach, and that is the former coach of Port, Ken Hinckley. Of course, the fellow candidates who were talked about at the time, John Longmire and Nathan Buckley, they were informed yesterday. So what does this mean for the Tassie Devils? How hard is it to be an inaugural coach anyway? Joel Bowden is the former AFL Best and Fairest for Richmond and former Players Association president joining me now. Hi, Joel. How are you going?
Hey, Mary. I'm well. I'm a little bit tired. Got up quite early this morning to watch the soccer.
Exactly. Well, I should ask you, what's your score out of 10 for the World Cup?
We enjoyed it here. I'm in Darwin, so the office, we got into it, and we've got a very multicultural office, so I would give it a 7.74 out of 10. That's 774 ABC Melbourne.
Oh, Joel, I love your style. I love your style. That's fantastic. yes, and I think that we're all going to be a bit bereft after, how many days was it? How many months was this World Cup? Anyway.
It went for a while, but I'm on coffee number 4, so I think I'll be okay.
Excellent. Tell me, as Joel will tell me, what do you think of Ken Hinckley as the Tassie Devils coach, and what will be the most important thing for him to be thinking about? 1300 222 774. Joel, what was your reaction to the announcement?
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised because I thought Nathan Buckley was the front runner, and Nathan Buckley is a Territorian, and we certainly claim him in the Northern Territory. So I would have loved for Nathan to be the coach of the Tassie Devils. But my mate Brendan Gale, who was poached from Richmond to be the CEO down there, he's clearly gone through a process with his board, and I know Alistair Lynch was on the panel, so they've done a thorough due diligence, and they've picked a guy who coached 13 season at Port Adelaide, who are a very, very parochial club, and, you know, we know about Port Adelaide and their supporters. He had a 58% win ratio through his 13 seasons there, and they've gone and chose someone who's, I think, a players player. And, you know, as you said, I was the Players Association president. I have a very player-centric view of what needs to be done, and I think Hinckley is the right bloke because retention's going to be crucial. Recruitment they'll be able to do through the draft, but retention and making sure that the culture and the environment allows for the players who go to Tasmania, and they'll be, you know, living in Hobart, that they can grow, they can develop, and then they can also have success.
So what was it that do you think took him over the line? Was it that aspect of being a player's coach? He also has that history in Port Adelaide. Does he have a sort of an understanding of what it means to sort of create a niche in the National League?
I think he does, because Port came into the competition, you know, in the late 90s, and not that he was the inaugural coach, but he had to pick up from some really, really strong coaches there, Mark Williams, John Cale, who started out. And Port are very parochial, you know, like it's in South Australia, you either barrack for Port Adelaide or you don't. It's like Collingwood in Melbourne. Everyone else barracks against Collingwood in Melbourne or against Port Adelaide in Adelaide. So I think he'll be going down. He won't just be coaching the Devils, he'll be coaching the whole state. Like, the whole state will get behind him. And don't forget, there was 100,000 members when Tasmanian Devils put out their membership drive just, I think it was about 12 or 18 months ago. So, you know, Ken's got that understanding. He also played in Geelong, so he understands about the one-team town. And potentially that was it that got him over the line. But also he was able to retain all these players at Port Adelaide when he was there as a coach. So 13 seasons, a harmonious club, even in that pressure cooker, maybe that was the little thing that got him over the line, because Buckley was also in contention. John Longmire was in contention, and we know how qualified and what qualities they have, being both grand final and premiership coaches in the AFL. So there was a lot of availability, which is unusual in the AFL system. I even think Adam Simpson was hovering around. So there's three or four ex-senior AFL coaches who were in the mix.
1300 222 774. If you've got an opinion on Ken Hinckley down in Tassie, if you have any other thoughts about what it could have, should have been, I'm speaking with Joel Bowden. Joel, you said he's there to coach the whole state, as it were. As you say, your good mate Brendan Gale has been laying the groundwork for this. We know Tassie people love their footy. What do you think, well set up do you think they are? Will they already have that head start because of, you know, the momentum behind this? Or on the other hand, are there challenges about this that you think that they need to overcome?
Well, there's challenges with recruitment. And again, as I said, being a, having a player-centric view, former Players Association president, I think there's going to be recruitment and down the track retention. But the AFL have had some lessons learned from GWS and Gold Coast. Just a quick look at what they're going to have to do in the draft. So the AFL have allocated Tassie Devils picks number 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11 and 13. But they can't keep them all. They must trade number 5, 7, 11 and 13. And in the next 18 months, they can sign 18 uncontracted AFL players. So they're trying to put some experience into the team to start with. Mm. And that's part of that. They must trade those picks 5, 7, 11 and 13. And then they can get uncontracted players in. And GWS did this well under Kevin Sheedy, in my view, where they got blokes like Luke Power, Chad Corns and a number of experienced players who went to GWS to nurture and mentor the players on the field. They had Sheedy as the, you know, the patriarch, and Mark Williams was there off the field. So I think not only will they put a really good, strong coaching team around them, they'll put some senior players in there. And you'll see guys probably go to the Devils who are on this, you know, maybe they've got 2 or 3 years left in them, and they help set up the club and help set up the playing group. And that's something that Brendan Gale, that Ken Hinckley now are going to be responsible for, as well as the entire state getting behind them, which we saw with the Jack Jumpers, who went into the basketball just two seasons ago and had immediate success. But the coach from the Jack Jumpers was saying he felt like he was coaching the entire state. So there's a lot on Ken Hinckley's shoulders, and I'm sure he'll do well. He's got, you know, 18 months before he gets started, and I hope Brendan Gale, my former Richmond colleague and friend, does very well down there, because I've spent time in Tasmania, and I think it's going to be a really, really, really good opportunity. And then what happens is all eyes go to that 20th team, and then I'm going to be parochial about that and say, if there's ever a 20th licence, the Northern Territory will be putting our hand up for it.
Absolutely. Northern Territory, you're putting in the groundwork up there. You could be the coach for that. And you've got so much talent to draw on. You've got your eyes on that, Joel.
We've got talent, that's for sure. But it'll be there'll be the same challenges if the Northern Territory is ever lucky enough to get an AFL team. There'll be the same challenges. And the AFL will now have, you know, 6 or 7 AFL clubs that have come in since Frio, since Adelaide, Port Adelaide, GWS, Gold Coast, now Tasmania. We would like to think that when we get a chance, we'll bid for the 20th licence and we'll get the support we need.
Let's see if the AFL demands a stadium, but that's a whole other conversation. Joel Bowden, thank you. Great talking with
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, Mary.
Joel Bowden is, of course, a former Players Association president and Richmond veteran. You are listening to The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Now, coming up soon this hour, The Odyssey, everyone's talking about it. Have you seen it? Let me know. Can there be a spoiler if it's an ancient myth? Say whatever you want. I don't think you can spoil it. Also, we're going to cross to get a sense of the state funeral that's happening soon for Derryn Hinch. But next, tell me your theory. What has made it potentially more dangerous to be moving around on foot in Victoria?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
I'm asking you, what's your pet hate as a pedestrian? What do you think might be behind some disturbing stats we're talking about this morning? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. The pedestrian advocacy group Victoria Walks is calling on the Labor and Liberal parties to spend $150 million upgrading or installing road crossings across the state. And that's because data has shown that 33 pedestrians were killed on Victoria's roads in 2025, and that is higher than the five-year average of 22 per year, which is already unacceptable, isn't it? Kathy Lazanis is board member of Victoria Walks and joins me now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for joining us. What did you think when you heard these stats from last year?
Look, it's really terrible, and, you know, any death is one too many, and we really shouldn't be having that conversation, should we? You know, walking should be the thing that we should all be able to do, pop down to the shops, get the bus, whatever it might be. You know, we should be able to do that safely in our communities, and at the moment the numbers are going the wrong way, and that's what the data is telling us.
Mm. 1300 222 774 if you'd like to join the conversation. Have you got a theory about this? Kathy Lozanis is from Victoria Walks. Kathy, do you have a theory, even if it's a combination of factors, that would go behind explaining these stats?
Yeah, look, I think the reality is that, you know, we've got lots of people living in lots of areas, and the thing is with this conversation, it isn't just a metro conversation. You know, it's also a regional conversation. And as people get older, we need to be able to provide places where they can walk. And simple things like footpaths and connections and pedestrian crossings are actually the easiest thing we could do, but it's often forgotten about. And I think that's where the disconnect is, Mary. You know, does it rest with the state government? Does it rest with councils? And the reality is it needs all parts of government to work together to deliver this. And that's why, as Victoria Walks, we're asking for, regardless of which colour of, you know, politics you sit on, we're asking for the setup of a Victorian Safe Connections Fund to deliver $150 million to deliver 1,000 pedestrian crossings over the next 4 years.
Pedestrian crossings, are they the answer? 1300 222 774 to join the conversation. Kathy, I am already seeing a flavour on texts which is about pedestrian behaviour, and of course our hearts go out to anyone who's been injured as well as worse on the roads here as a pedestrian. I'm sure there's no sense of victim blaming in particular in individuals. But in terms of actual behaviour in general, as a society, many more of us are guilty. I'm guilty of being less aware of my surroundings on the road. What does Victoria Walks believe about that, that factor in what we're seeing? Does it count at all in your mind? And does that go into the design of these road crossings?
Look, I think that's, you know, human behaviour has changed and technology has definitely been a part of that. But, you know, it isn't about victim blaming. This is where, you know, the day and age we live in. And it's about understanding how people use our streets and how they walk. And I think the important part here is to really tap into being able to deliver the environment that is as safe as possible for people to be able to cross. And it isn't just about, you know, whether it's people that might have their headphones in or it might be on a walk. The reality is it's also driving and speeds as well. So it's about both. It's a combination of things. And that's where what we see when pedestrian crossings are installed in our local streets and communities, it calms everything down. You know, you have a very, very clear signal for where pedestrians can cross. If it's a raised crossing, you know, we call them wombat crossings, you know, that has that on that speed hump. So cars are naturally forced to slow down that little bit extra. And it just makes that whole environment a little bit calmer.
So some of these design elements could be to essentially wake up both the pedestrians and the other road users.
Absolutely.
Yeah. James in Kyneton, what did you want to say in this conversation, James?
Well, I go to Melbourne every Wednesday to babysit my granddaughter, and walking around South Melbourne, I've noticed that every day I'm down there, the trams, cars will pass a stationary tram, making it dangerous for the passengers getting off or those attempting to get on. Mm. And the other thing, I was like, when I cross roads at lights, I often have to stop in the middle of the road where cars will turn in front of me, either turn left or turn right in front of me, making it dangerous for both me and my granddaughter. So I'm talking about, I think, bad motorist behaviour is what I'm seeing in South Melbourne anyway.
Right. James, you just broke up a little there, but I hear what you were saying is about cars not stopping with trams and about drivers not looking out, turning left and right. Yes, I'm sure, especially it's not just South Melbourne that you've been seeing that. Julianne in Coburg, what do you think?
Oh, hello. Hang on, I've got to turn you. I can hear you.
Yes, you can hear me. We can hear you, Julianne. Did you want to talk about pedestrians on the road?
Yes, I do. I'm just hearing my echo. Sorry.
All right. I might just put you back to the producers, if I may, because they might be able to help you with that. We're talking to Kathy Lozanis, who's a board member of Victoria Walks, about the figures that we've heard. I've seen some questions on text saying, what's the breakdown? We're talking about a statewide picture there. Is there more of a problem in towns, busy towns, than the regions, Kathy?
Look, I think this actually goes to the other part of the issue that we have around this, Mary, which is data. And, you know, while you are, you know, you headline by sort of talking about the deaths, the reality is that there's a lot of injuries or even near misses, and the data isn't as deep as we'd like it to be. And that's regardless if it's in the regions or metro areas. So, you know, that's also a critical part of actually being able to change people's behaviour, to actually know what's going on out there as well.
Mm. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Wendy in Carlton, what's been your experience? Hello, Wendy.
Hi. I ride a mobility scooter, and I am constantly concerned by people who have earphones on.
Wendy, you still there? Oh, Wendy, might have just broken up there, Wendy. I'll put you on hold and see if we can get you back there too. Yes, it's about the headphones. This has come in on text as well, Kathy, talking about comparing it with the Singapore experience, where they have billboards and stickers on the footpath that say, look up, with a crossed out mobile phone sign. Does it come to that as well? Do we need more of an education campaign?
I think that, you know, everything, every little bit helps is the reality of this. And you know, I don't think it's a, this is a challenge of safety and walking. And it's not only just about the physical environment, it's also about feeling safe as well. And having those signals that's really clear to motorists, but also for pedestrians, that this is their right of way, is what, you know, it goes a long way with pedestrian crossings to be able to do that. So, yeah, I definitely think that there's a behavioural element to it as well as a campaign, but it's actually that physical infrastructure that's missing, Mary. And, you know, the challenge with that is that we know that our councils, and we've got lots of member councils in our organisation, and, you know, they tell us that the projects are there ready to go. They just need the funding to deliver them.
And, Kathy, what's the next step? I mean, what, for people who want more in their community, it has to be going through councils and so forth, but you're calling on them to pressure their state MPs?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned, we're calling for the establishment of a Victorian Safe Connections Fund to be set up, and that's asking for $150 million, which will deliver, we think, about 1,000 pedestrian crossings over the next 4 years. And the transformation that will have on our local towns and communities will be absolutely incredible. And we know that because we see it in those areas that happen. It's that walk, if you think about, to your local shops or to the local primary school, it just transforms our communities in no other way. So we're really imploring all sides of, you know, politics to really get behind this idea.
Kathy Lozanis, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Mary.
Kathy Lozanis is board member of Victoria Walks, and keep those calls and texts coming. We'll try and get to that conversation because it is concerning all of us, of course. Coming up in the Conversation Hour, though, very, very soon, we will be talking about the state funeral for Darren Hinch that starts at noon. We'll be crossing to Ben Knight, a reporter there, but also, have you been one of the lucky ones to go and see The Odyssey? Yes, it's the movie of the moment, the blockbuster we've all been waiting for. And it has all of the ancient myth wonks among us very, very excited. I'm going to be speaking to one of them next to get his impressions as not just a Homeric scholar, but a film buff as well. But I want to hear what you think. 1300 222 774. Have you seen The Odyssey? What do you think of it?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, if you wanted to get your kids interested in ancient myths, look no further. Christopher Nolan, who has been breaking box office records and breaking the envelopes when it comes to taking stories and putting them on the big screen. Well, he's done it again. The Odyssey is what everyone has been waiting for. It just has been released a few days ago. People lucky enough to get IMAX tickets are doing so because it was shot fully in IMAX. That's one thing about the production, the lush production. But what about the notion of taking something so seminal to our culture, so broad and sweeping, and making it groovy? Yes, the ancients have riz, I'm calling it. Yes, I'm making all the youth among us cringe. I want to know, are ancients Groovy again, 1300 222 774. I want all of you Myth fans to tell me what you have made of it. Joining me now is Dr. Ben Ferris, who's a filmmaker, Homeric scholar, and an academic at Sydney Uni. Ben, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, what do we need to know? Can you give us a cheat sheet about the Odyssey before we walk in? Is there anything we need to know?
Well, before we watch Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey, I think one of the strokes of brilliance of Nolan is that he's made this story accessible for a modern audience. Mm-hmm. And that is no mean feat in and of itself, because you've got to distill essentially stories across what were originally, at least in text form, 24 books. And he's got to synthesize, work through all of those stories into 3 hours of screen time. So that is the scale of the challenge.
That was his challenge. And now I'm asking you to sum it up in about 30 seconds. How would you sum up the story, as you say, the grand sweeping story of the Odyssey?
It is a story of a man, Odysseus, hence why it's called The Odyssey, of a man trying to return home, and then he ultimately does so with some complications on the way. He is a veteran of a 10-year war that was fought on the shores of Troy, as told in Homer's other epic poem, The Iliad. So this is his journey homewards, his attempt to reconnect with his wife Penelope, who's been waiting for him over this 20-year period. And that's it in a hyper-abbreviated nutshell.
Yeah, that's right. And just before we get into the movie itself, how significant is the Odyssey, would you sum up, to our culture and our thinking?
I can't state enough how significant it is. It underlies a lot of our modern assumptions, biases, storytelling, culture. We kind of live and breathe the Odyssey without knowing it. And that's because of these significant archetypes that are at play, that are informing our views about the world, about gender, about attitude towards adventure, towards home. It is a fundamental civilizing work that affects all of us on a day-to-day basis, even, I would say.
Mm. 1300 222 774. Have you seen The Odyssey? What have you thought? And what do you think about interpreting such a seminal text? I'm talking to Dr. Ben Ferris, who's an academic at Sydney Uni, a filmmaker and Homeric scholar, so he's the perfect person to talk about it. And Ben, you have seen the movie. What did you think?
Look, I'm a fan. I think it's a masterpiece for the reason that I mentioned before, the way that Nolan is able to weave so many layers of storytelling into this. 3 hours might feel long, but relative to the 24 books of The Odyssey, it is an exceptional way of weaving these stories together to make them both accessible for a modern audience, but also compelling, I think, and deeply moving at points. So I'm a fan.
You're a fan. You're also right down the rabbit hole when it comes to this text and the meaning of this text and the significance of the text. So what's your point of view about reinterpreting it? Has it done well in that sense? Has it been, quote-unquote, faithful enough in your view?
Yeah, well, the question of faithful is a tricky one. I don't really assess it on the basis of, you know, its success on the basis of being faithful. More is whether it's an intelligent adaptation of the interpretation. Everything's an interpretation. You can't set out and tell the story exactly the way that Homer did it, that you're going to fail from the beginning. So everything's an interpretation. To tell the story again in our times, through a modern lens as someone that's living and breathing in the 21st century, it has to be a reinterpretation of something that was composed so long ago. So it's not about being faithful is for me about engaging really meaningfully and purposefully with Homer's Odyssey, but then ultimately making it something accessible, compelling in its own way, in speaking the language of its times. It has to. So I think that is a massive task. That is an incredibly challenging juggling act.
Yeah.
And there have been many who've sort of failed along the way, I feel, in that. But I think Nolan's just about pulled it off. Yeah.
Has he pulled it off? Give us a call, 1300 222 774. If you've seen it, if you're wanting to see it, tell me why. I'm speaking with Dr. Ben Ferris about The Odyssey, of course. And Ben, you mentioned the 21st century world in which this lands. And of course, being 21st century, there's a subsection of the online world that's had a go, particularly far-right commentators, prominently among them Elon Musk, who've had a go for being woke. They've picked on the casting in particular of Academy Award-winning actress Lupita Nyong'o as Helen of Troy, obviously known as the most beautiful woman in Greek mythology. Just so people get an idea of the nature of this criticism, here's conservative podcaster Megyn Kelly talking to Australian Sky TV last week.
You are not allowed to stay true to, you know, white culture, whatever that is, or just, you know, a story that's about whites. Like Helen of Troy was in the original writing a white person, but had to be made black because you can't win an Oscar if everybody's white in your movie.
So that's Megyn Kelly. A little taste of what's happening in a corner of the online world. Ben, she's describing Homer's version of Helen as definitively white. What do you make of that and also this kind of critique?
Well, I think this kind of critique's really interesting because it definitely speaks to some of our concerns of our time in the 21st century, coming back to that idea and the concerns of the people that are saying these things. It's perhaps more reflective of who we are now in the way that we're responding to Homer. The other thing that's probably worth mentioning is she refers to original writing. The complicating and unique and wonderful thing about Homer's The Odyssey and the Iliad, in fact, is that it is actually a work that has come to us from this amazingly rich tradition that the ancient Greeks have bequeathed us of oral storytelling. Mm. And this oral storytelling has gone back over centuries, and these stories are being told orally and then passed down and then refined. And these stories are going back into myth, into religious ideas, into folk tale.
So this idea of compromising something presented as fact is beside the point, you're saying?
Well, that's right, yes. It's very hard. The idea of fact when it comes to Homer really problematizes, challenges that idea, because it's not a historical text in the way that, you know, even Thucydides' writings on the Peloponnesian War is a historical text. It's an accumulation of these fictional stories that do have a basis in historical events, and they're touching on these. But it's essentially a work of fiction. It's essentially a work of storytelling, how we create these incredible, compelling stories and pass them on from generation to generation.
Nothing like the 21st century just to complicate something like that.
That's right. And so the idea of, you know, you can't approach the Odyssey as a work that is a written work for a start, because it ultimately became written. There was at some point in its transmission history, it was recorded and written down. Mm. But it's at the tail end of this very long refinement process of oral storytelling, and it's finally come to us in the form that it has. So in and of itself, the work, it's one of the fascinating things about the Odyssey, and you find it, evidence of this, in there is that the work itself is speaking across, pointing back centuries, like layers of time overlapping.
And so to finish, Ben, how important then and exciting, I guess I'm hearing in your voice as well, is it that it's being introduced to a new and younger audience?
Oh, I think it's just absolutely wonderful. I mean, obviously, I'm completely biased. This is a world that I've long loved. The fact that, you know, I can actually now walk down the street and have conversations with others about my secret passion is wonderful. That the fact that Nolan has made it accessible and is terrific. So it's a really exciting moment. I think it's a moment in cinema history. It's a monumental. So yeah, I'm excited.
Have fun with your area of expertise and research becoming super cool, Ben Ferris, and thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's always been cool. Just waiting for everyone to catch up.
Ben Ferris, thank you. That's Dr. Ben Ferris. What did you think of The Odyssey? Are you as excited as Ben Ferris? Ian from Hampton, what did you think? You've seen it?
Yes, I've seen the movie.
Yes, what'd you think?
It was a bit long.
It is 3 hours, is that right?
It's 3 hours, yeah, approximately 3 hours. And I made the comment to your producer that I felt that Matt Damon wasn't the right person for the role of Odysseus.
Why's that?
I just felt that he needed to be a more physical type of person.
Oh, really?
More like a Chris Hemsworth or Eric Banner, perhaps.
Okay. Yep, should have been our Eric.
Yeah, that's right. And the other point I was making was that I think you needed to know the story before you actually go and see the movie.
Oh, really?
Because if you don't know anything about the Iliad and the Odyssey, you're going to get completely befuddled by what's going on.
Right.
There were certain episodes within the movie that I thought weren't totally explained. For example, the interaction with the Cyclops. I don't want to be a spoiler, but yeah.
Can you really spoil an ancient text? I'm in defense of you here, Ian. Oh, that's really interesting. Thank you. Yeah, I think that's been part of how people think about Christopher Nolan. He leaves a lot unsaid. Maybe when it's trying to put something so big on the screen, it's a bit too much. Tell me what you think. I do see on text, though, as opposed to what Ian says, look, that three-hour film kept me engaged the whole time. Lots of people asking if there's an intermission. No, I don't think there is. We're coming towards the end of the conversation hour, but stick around. We're going to be getting the details of the state funeral of Darren Hinch, one of the biggest names in media in Australia. That's next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Joining me now is Ben Knight, who is on the scene of the state funeral for Darren Hinch. Thanks for joining me, Ben. It's happening in Port Melbourne.
Yeah, you wanted the Comedy Theatre, but it was booked out, so we're at the Timber Yard in Port Melbourne.
And how big is it?
It's biggish. I mean, absolutely. Darren was a massive figure, but also he was 82. So, you know.
A lot of friends to come.
So I think some have probably haven't quite made it to the starting line of this one. I mean, and look, you know, I'll tell you something. I mean, the reason I'm here covering this is because they had a look around the newsroom and realised that most of the other reporters were too young to be actually full bottle on who Darren Hinch was. But, of course, you and I would well remember when he was a big thing on radio and TV.
Oh, absolutely, and all of our listeners as well, I'm sure. I mean, the man was nicknamed the human headline. Part is insult, but also I think partly in tribute. Can you give us an idea of the sort of people who are turning up there today, Ben?
Oh, yeah, look, no
is
one
it public?
That, It's public, yeah. So, look, we were sort of, you know, as you do, you sort of stand at the front door and look for some famous faces, and the first one to wander in was Ray Martin. So, okay, well, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and because Ray was also obviously one of those massive media figures from the 80s and the 90s. But he and Darren were good friends and had been for a really long time. In fact, ever since... Darren was, I think, 18 or 19 years old, where he sort of found himself working for a Sydney newspaper in the New York Bureau, and Ray Martin was there for the ABC. So they were there for years together and got along really, really well. So, look, you know, Ray's here. He's going to be playing a big part in the ceremony this afternoon. And then you're sort of like, oh, is that Rhonda Birchmore? Yeah, it would be. Yep. Oh, God, Greg Evans. Haven't seen him since I saw Perfect Match. So the rest of them are all sort of like commercial radio figures from the sort of 80s and 90s. And but I'll tell you one thing. There are members of the public here, and they are here for a reason. There was one guy I had a quick chat with on the way in who I had... I knew. I've dealt with him before. In fact, I've interviewed him before. He's done with that now, so he didn't want to go on camera or have his name mentioned today. But, I mean, the reason he's here is because he was literally listening to the radio and heard Darren Hinch doing an interview, and he said, if you are a victim of sexual abuse, do not go to the institution because you will get nowhere. And in this case, this was the Catholic Church. Darren had said, go to the police, and that's what this man did, and that was the beginning of a long, traumatic, but ultimately effective effort for him to get some restitution and some justice. So I don't think he even met Darren, but he's here today to pay his respects, because, of course, that was a big part of, when you talk about, you know, the human headline, Darren's impact for good or bad.
That's right.
Sexual abuse was such a massive part of it. He went to jail for it, for breaching contempt of court and suppression orders when it came to exposing perpetrators who, in the case of Michael Glennon, was still working as a Catholic priest, and Darren outed him and shouldn't have done so according to the law, and went to jail for it. That didn't stop him. He he breached further suppression orders and found himself in home detention. He doesn't regret any of that. And I think the thing that disappointed him most in his life was not getting re-elected as a senator.
He certainly had a full life. Ben Knight, thank you for letting us have a little bit of an insight into what's happening there for him.
Thanks, Mary.
Ben Knight, ABC reporter at the state funeral for Darren Hinch. We are also going to Ringwood, as is 774 this week. I'll be at the Realm Library in Ringwood on Wednesday from 11. So please come down. I'd love to talk to you, have your say. If you can't get to Ringwood as well, you can have your say at abc.net.au/your say. And this has been The Conversation Hour. Talk to you again tomorrow.